four-part harmony. Preceding the film will be a special short talk on the power of music in African society by Baba Wage Jakete, renowned artist and storyteller from Mali. That's Tuesday, February 11th at 7 p.m., Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University, with five part-time MBA programs that combine classic business skills with an emphasis on creative thinking, ethical decision-making, and sound judgment, the hallmarks of a liberal arts perspective. January 25th, informational session, merrillhurst.edu.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Geneva II Conference, which aims to reach a political conclusion to the Syrian war, began yesterday in Montreux, Switzerland.
The trial of the NATO 3 activists who were accused of plotting terrorism in 2012 continues in Chicago.
The Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board has released a report calling for an end to the National Security Agency's phone metadata collection programs.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 23rd, 2014. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm Robert Barncord. A recent Gallup poll has found that 2 out of 3 Americans are unhappy with the way wealth and income are distributed here in the United States. Less than 1 in every 14 people reported that they are very satisfied with the current distribution of wealth. That's less than 7%. The poll comes in the midst of what economists are terming an economic recovery here in the U.S., but the economic recovery over the last 5 years has actually increased the gap between rich and poor people here in the United States. While the top 7% saw their wealth increase, the bottom 93% increase in their net worth over the last 5 years. A leader of the anti-poverty organization Oxfam says that this is no accident, claiming that growing inequality has been driven by a power grab by the economic elite. According to the new poll, Americans are even starting to doubt their ability to be successful through hard work and perseverance. The percent of Americans who believe that hard work will pay off dropped from almost 80% as recently as 2002 to 67% in 2008, and then to barely over 50% in the most recent poll.
The American Psychological Association has decided to drop a complaint against one of their members who oversaw and directed torture against prisoners at Guantanamo Bay prison camp. Psychologist John Lesso designed torture techniques, then directed U.S. soldiers using the techniques in 2002 at Guantanamo. A complaint filed against Lesso in 2007 has only now been addressed by the association, and their response to the complaint was to dismiss it completely. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with psychologist Steven Reisner, who has tried to hold both Lesso and the American Psychological Association accountable.
Can you comment on the decision by the American Psychological Association to dismiss the complaint against John Lesso, accused of engaging in torture at Guantanamo Bay?
Well, this decision by the American Psychological Association to dismiss the complaint after 7 years is distressing, I think, on a number of levels. First of all, it's distressing that a case as clear as the case of John Lesso, where there is much documentation that he co-wrote the torture protocols at Guantanamo, that he was present and overseeing one of the worst cases of torture known that the American military instituted for a month and a half. I mean, it was a terrible torture process of Al-Qahtani. And John Lesso came up with many of the techniques and oversaw the torture, and it's documented in public documents. And the American Psychological Association, cherry-picking all of the information, thousands of pages, found one or two sentences where John Lesso shared some ambivalence and therefore decided to basically exonerate him. So it's distressing that there has been no accountability on any level in this country for the torture perpetrated in our name. It's distressing as a nation. It's distressing particularly for psychologists and health professionals who are supposed to be held to an even higher standard of doing no harm. So the fact that the American Psychological Association did not attempt to hold one of its members accountable for torture takes apart the very basis by which we trust our psychologists to behave ethically, not only in military situations, but in all situations. We have to believe that there's meaning in our ethical principles.
In the main case that was brought up in the complaint, Mohammed Al-Qahtani, can you talk about some of the torture techniques that were overseen by psychologist John Lesso?
We don't have direct evidence of which of the techniques he was present and directing, but we do know that during that period, sexually humiliated, he was his religion was attacked, he was forced to be awake for 20 hours a day, he was subject to extreme cold, he in fact was brought to the hospital on at least one, maybe more occasions because of the terribly abusive nature of that interrogation. In fact, the judge overseeing the military tribunals at Guantanamo, a Bush-appointed judge, Susan Crawford, called Al-Qahtani's treatment torture. I mean, there's no doubt that this was a case of torture, and there's no doubt that John Lesso was a supervisor on that process. That's very clear.
Do you think that this brings into question the credibility of the American Psychological Association as the main organization representing psychologists in the U.S.?
I think that this is an embarrassing, tragic moment for the American Psychological Association. I think that this their entire history of basically supporting psychologist participation in these types of interrogations, which they have done since 2005, sullied the reputation of the American Psychological Association. Psychologists now know that we cannot turn to this association for guidance in the most difficult ethical dilemmas that we face.
I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Reisner. He's with the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology, talking about the decision by against psychologist John Lesso, who was involved in the torture of accused 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Al-Qahtani in Guantanamo. Neither Dr. Lesso nor any other U.S. official has ever faced charges or any other type of accountability for the treatment of detainees at Guantanamo. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A government panel set up to protect American civil liberties issued a report today calling for an end to the National Security Agency's phone and internet data collection programs. The Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board was created from recommendations by the 9/11 Commission, but its implementation was delayed until the year 2012, years after Congress called for its creation. Zeke Johnson, the director for Security and Human Rights Campaign at Amnesty International, spoke with KBOO reporter Robin Ryan about the report, which he believes indicates a shift in political will on the issue of governmental overreach.
The Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board has issued a lengthy report about the legality of the National Security Agency's phone records collections programs. And this report concludes that the practice is not constitutional. For folks not familiar with the agency, can you provide a little historical context?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the collection of mass data by the U.S. government is really a global problem. And what the review board did today is say that a narrow part of that global collection program, specifically the collection of telephone metadata under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, is illegal and was ineffective and should be scrapped. And we at Amnesty International completely agree Congress should move forward with getting rid of that bulk collection program. And the way to do that is for members of Congress and senators to support the USA Freedom Act. That's a piece of bipartisan legislation introduced by Senator Leahy of Vermont and Representative Sensenbrenner, who actually was one of the Patriot Act. He's now turned against some parts of it. This would help end the bulk collection that the review board found so problematic today. But it wouldn't go far enough. We need Congress and the administration to do far more to make sure that mass collection of data for anyone, anywhere, surveillance can be lawful, it can be effective, but it has to be narrow in scope, it has to be extremely targeted, and it's got to be necessary and proportionate to that legitimate objective. You can't just collect everyone's data and then eventually at some point root through it to see if you can find something bad. There's got to be constraints on this. There have to be safeguards, and that's what we're calling for.
Can you go over what the key findings were in this report?
The review board found that the 215 metadata collection program was illegal and that it really was not effective in countering any sort of potential attacks by armed groups. And they found that this should be scrapped, that Congress should move to tighten the law and to make sure that the government is not sucking up mass volumes of telephone data.
Did this report speak to the impact of such policies on a free media?
I think the report board definitely recognizes that, you know, this isn't just about the collection of data and the right to privacy, but that, you know, freedom of expression, freedom of journalism, the freedom of association, all these rights that are interconnected with privacy are really important, and they all hang together. And that this mass surveillance program can really have a chilling effect on free speech, free association, and on reporters who need to talk to people all around the world to do their job. So I think that there's definitely consensus growing across the political spectrum that the NSA mass surveillance program is out of control and needs to be reined in. And the review board today definitely agreed with that. So there really should be the final nail in the coffin for the bulk collection of telephone data in the U.S.
What was the question posed to the board to get the 3-2 result?
That was on the narrow question of whether this telephone metadata program was illegal or not, whether it violated the Constitution. And so the majority of the board said that it was illegal, and two of the people disagreed. But still, the overall finding remains from all of them that the program, whether it's lawful or not, should be scrapped. Definitely from an international human rights perspective, the bulk collection of data is extremely flawed. You can't just suck up everyone's information and just hold it around, and so someday you might want to use it or not. You just can't collect data in that way. It violates the rights of private non-Americans. You know, again, surveillance has to be narrow in scope, extremely targeted, and take place within a system of law and a system of checks and balances. And that's the standard that the mass collection program violates.
Who would be behind efforts to lobby in opposition to protecting the First and the Fourth Amendments?
Well, probably the people who authorized this kind of bulk surveillance in the first place, they want to be seen as having done something legitimate and that wasn't a problem. And so I think those are probably, you know, the intelligence agencies and the people in the administration that give them the authority to do these things are probably the ones that don't want to see a change. There's also people in Congress, you know, who, you know, have basically given the thumbs up to these mass surveillance programs. And those people probably don't want to see reform. But we've been really thankful for Senator Wyden out in Oregon for his efforts to really try to rein this program in. And you know, people should let their members of Congress, their senators, know where they stand on this issue because those elected officials are there in D.C. to represent us. And so they need to know how we feel. I think what people should realize is that the surveillance issue is part of a broader issue that's going on here in the United States. And that's that for over a decade, the U.S. government has used this sort of premise of basically a never-ending, vaguely defined global war against armed groups to justify a range of human rights violations, from indefinite detention at Guantanamo to the CIA torture program to drone strikes outside the bounds of the law around the world. And this mass surveillance program is one piece of that. So it's not just about addressing the amendments for human rights that presents, So we need to dismantle this overall idea of a forever war because it's led to so many bad things. You know, again, we all want justice for 9/11. We all want security from armed groups. But the way to do that is through respecting and upholding human rights, not violating them.
I've been talking with Zeke Johnson. He's the director of Amnesty International USA's Security and Human Rights Campaign. For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
On Tuesday, the trial of the so-called NATO 3 began in Chicago. The three men in their 20s were arrested during the 2012 NATO summit held in that city and accused with plotting terrorist attacks and currently face 40 years in prison. Their attorneys argue that the men were just drunken loudmouths who were egged on by undercover police officers and that the city's law enforcement community was desperate for convictions that would justify their huge expenditures on security for the summit. Sarah Gelsomino, attorney for alleged ringleader Brian Church, says that the trial will be crucial for determining when the state can label someone a terrorist. The three men had met as part of the Occupy movement and were visiting Chicago from Florida. They befriended two undercover police officers, Nadia Chico and Mohamed Gwen, who were tasked with investigating coffee shops, concerts, protests, and meetings for news of potential illegal activity. The two cops are heard on tape with the three men making four Molotov cocktails and discussing plans to do battle with police in the street, destroy Chase Tower in the Loop, and shoot an arrow with a note into Mayor Rahm Emanuel's home. At one point, Church can be heard saying, quote, "Are you ready to see a police officer on fire?" end quote. The defense claims, however, that Church was more of a stoned, drunken braggart than an actual security threat, and that he was trying to impress the female undercover officer with tough talk. He can also be heard asking for more beer and stating that he can't go anywhere until his dealer shows up. Gelsomino accused the two officers of plying Church with alcohol into following through on his boasts, buying him countless drinks, even though he was 20 years old at the time. The attorneys for the other men have also made the case that they are not terrorists, even openly mocking the state's evidence and questioning whether the thick dogfish head beer bottles used to make the Molotov cocktails would even break when thrown. The trial is ongoing and is Cook County's first terrorism case.
After 3 years of investigation, one employee of Halliburton has received a one-year probation for destroying evidence about the worst oil spill in U.S. history. The Deepwater Horizon oil spill released over 200 million gallons of oil and killed 10 people in 2010. The economic ramifications and damage to the ecosystem can still be felt today. After pleading guilty to destroying evidence, Anthony Badalamenti received 1 year probation, 100 hours of community service, and a $1,000 fine. After the disaster, in an effort to cover mistakes, Badalamenti told other employees to delete information related to the concrete failure that led to the accident. In today's sentencing hearing, the presiding judge said the honorable man who has learned from his mistakes. The comments from the judge enraged survivors and families of victims of the accident. The fishing industry and many independent businesses who rely on the Gulf have never completely recovered since the accident, which happened 4 years ago. Halliburton, a multinational, multi-billion-dollar corporation, is facing a $200 million fine and a non-binding pledge to give $55 million to the Fish and Wildlife Foundation for the damages.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Lewis and Clark College professor Tung Yin by KBOO's Joe Meyer on the one-year anniversary of the trial of Mohamed Mahmoud, followed by Wisdom of the Elders at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather will be clear with a high of 51 and a low of 37. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are Damascus, Oregon, has 31 counts per minute and a high of 56. Powell Butte measures 27 CPM. In Raleigh Hills, the radiation count is 29 CPM with a high of 53. Seaside, Oregon has 32 CPM with a high of 61. Hanford, Washington has 28 CPM with a high of 50. And in Victoria, British Columbia, there's a radiation count of 24 counts per minute with spike up to 63. EPA alert levels start at 100 counts per minute. More information can be found at radcast.org.
Hey, it's 5:23 and time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Rosa Parks became a powerful symbol of courage and defiance in the civil rights movement of the 1960s by simply refusing to give up her seat to a white man and move to the back of the bus, as the racist culture of that time dictated she was supposed to do. Only, there was nothing simple about it. As personally courageous as she was, Miss Parks was not alone that day. Nor was her defiance simply the spontaneous reaction of a woman who was tired. Tired after a long day of work. Tired of domineering white rule. Tired of going along to get along. Parks was part of a deep and wide grassroots movement for African-American rights and dignity. It was this movement that developed the sit-down strategy, trained Parks for this moment of refusal, and surrounded her with the support and love she needed to withstand the clamor of hate that followed. Rosa Parks was not alone on that bus. Half a century later, a new movement for justice is following in the footsteps and in the spirit of those earlier civil rights activists. Steadily building broad grassroots coalitions of civil rights groups, labor, church leaders, students, teachers, environmentalists, retirees, and others, this movement is literally moving through southern states. It's gaining popular support by directly confronting the immorality of extremist governors, legislators, and corporate lobbyists who are denying health care to poor families, preventing both the elderly and students from voting, gutting state funding for public education, and generally legislating a permanent state of inequality and injustice for millions of people. This is Jim Hightower saying, this promising progressive uprising began last year in North Carolina as the Moral Monday Movement, named for its weekly peaceful protests at the state capitol. It has now spread to Moral Monday, Georgia, and Truthful Tuesday in South Carolina. To follow its progress and offer support, go to www.naacpnc.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The European Union has presented its 2030 policy framework for climate and energy, and the plan immediately sparked criticism from environmental groups and renewable energy companies. The European Commission proposes to change their regulatory methods, essentially getting rid of the binding targets for carbon emissions they had established several years ago. The new plan would set overall European goals for renewable energy and carbon cutting instead of continuing the use of binding national targets. They set a goal for the European Union to get 27% of its energy from renewables by 2030 and 20% by 2020. The decision is a disappointment to renewable energy developers and producers, which expanded rapidly in the last decade with the help of mandatory targets on renewable energy use. Without mandates, the renewable energy market will be less predictable for investors, and critics question how the EU will meet its targets without member state obligations. The Commission also proposed a 40% cut in Europe's carbon emissions by 2030, following below Greenpeace's suggestion of a 55% cut in carbon emission. The Commission also decided against new laws on environmental damage and safety during fracking or hydraulic fracturing to extract shale gas.
Diesel-burning locomotives' engines across the United States will soon start burning natural gas instead of relying exclusively on diesel. Major railroad companies will begin testing new hybrid engines later this year. The engines burn a combination of diesel and natural gas. Both the manufacturers and the rail companies are advertising the fact that natural gas burns cleaner than diesel. But the main reason for the change is probably economic. Freight companies typically spend about one-fourth of their budget on fuel. Moving to a cheaper fuel source could significantly increase their profits. Natural gas has been promoted heavily as an alternative fuel in recent years, and the price has dropped by more than two-thirds over the past 5 years. The price drop is largely due to the increase in a controversial drilling practice known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. This practice comes with its own set of environmental and social concerns. Fracking has been linked to an increase in earthquakes in certain areas, as well as affecting soil and water quality. The move to natural gas will only affect a small percentage of the nation's freight trains, and most of them will continue to run on diesel.
Yesterday, officials in Beijing called for an end to new fossil fuel burning power plants, as well as steel mills, cement projects, and oil refining in the city. The ban takes effect in March. The local government intends to cut dangerous emissions by 5% this year by banning coal in some areas and limiting the number of vehicles on the road. There are plans to fine companies and revoke business licenses of those who do not comply with the new rules. This decision comes after a difficult summer last year in which Beijing residents found it hard to breathe or see as smog levels in the city hit record highs.
4 years after the earthquake that devastated the country of Haiti, the residents of the Caribbean nation are still rebuilding. The 7.0 earthquake killed an estimated 300,000 people and injured many more. In response, the world pledged more than $9 billion. A portion of that promised money was never delivered. Hundreds of thousands of Haitians continued to live in makeshift shelters and camps 4 years after the earthquake. Doctors Without Borders were one of the first responders to step in to help, and the group remains on the ground in Haiti 4 years later. KBOO's Genevieve McDaniel spoke with Anna Freeman with Doctors Without Borders.
Can you speak to what you did to help and what you saw in Haiti?
So I've worked in Haiti twice since the earthquake. Initially, I was there in January and February of 2010, immediately after the earthquake, working in an orthopedic hospital in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Then, at that point, the capital and many of the surrounding areas were completely destroyed from the earthquake. We worked to treat people who had been injured directly as a result of the earthquake, so mostly broken bones and other illnesses that came as a result from that. In 2013, I worked also in Port-au-Prince managing a cholera response project where we treated people who were ill with cholera.
Has the source of the cholera outbreak been identified?
There is a lot of evidence that the cholera that's in Haiti was introduced by the UN. This is a disease that was unknown in Haiti prior to the earthquake, and the first cases did appear near where the UN base was located.
What was the response regarding the cholera outbreak? How were the people of Haiti helped?
Since the cholera outbreak started in 2010, initially there was quite a lot of aid that came in, both for treatment programs, prevention programs, and eventually eradication efforts. Now, those efforts have really changed and are focusing mostly on eradication. That means that there is much less aid for treatment for people who are still falling ill and dying from cholera in Haiti.
It's been 4 years since the Haitian earthquake. What is the current status of rebuilding Haiti?
There's been a lot of progress made in some areas, although I think it's fair to say that there's a lot that remains left to be done. There are still people who are living in tent cities that have been there since the earthquake, many buildings that are still left to be rebuilt.
Billions of dollars were sent for aid money. Where has it all gone?
Well, I think, you know, some of it has gone to rebuilding. A lot of it has certainly gone to cleaning up after the earthquake. And there certainly have been many programs that have been started and continue today. But I think we know also that it's true that a lot of the aid money that was sent hasn't been used yet, or we don't know where it's gone.
What can people in Oregon do to help?
I think it's important to stay informed that this is not something that has gone away in Haiti. They still have cholera there. There are still many people who are falling ill and dying from this disease. So it's important that people are aware of that. This is something that hopefully will go away. And with the eradication efforts that are being made, we do remain hopeful that this is something that will end. However, right now it's important to understand that people are still sick and people are still dying from this disease. And actually, in higher numbers because there are fewer treatment options. So supporting organizations like Doctors Without Borders who are on the ground and working to treat this illness is very important.
I have been speaking with Anna Freeman from Doctors Without Borders. This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
The Geneva II conference, aiming to bring an end to the conflict in Syria and transition to a peaceful Syrian republic, began yesterday in Montreux, Switzerland, and will continue tomorrow in Geneva. The civil war in Syria has resulted in over 100,000 deaths, a colossal refugee crisis, and millions of people internally displaced, and it is widely thought that there is no possibility of a military solution to the conflict. However, as important as peace talks are, it has been extremely difficult to pull off this conference, and it continues to be beset by problems. For example, there are literally no women in either the government or opposition delegations, despite their prominent place in the original wave of protests that began in 2011. Also, large chunks of the opposition have rejected the conference in particular and a political solution in general, and the decision of the Syrian National Coalition to attend has further splintered the already divided opposition. This report from Al Jazeera highlights the tension at the conference, where simply keeping both sides at the table is considered a success.
And all Syrian people at the moment want the tourists to stop.
In a conference that's supposed to talk peace, the two sides are yelling at each other.
If you're Syrian, you fight with Syria.
The man is a pro-Syrian government journalist. The woman, a member of the opposition.
You are the terrorist! You are Daesh! You are the ISIS!
This may be just one moment on the conference sidelines. But in the conference hall, the diplomats are just as divided. The U.S. wants to create a transitional government and remove President Bashar al-Assad.
There is no way possible in the imagination that the man who has led the brutal response to his own people could regain the legitimacy to govern. One man and those who have supported him can no longer hold an entire nation and a region hostage.
In response, the Syrian foreign minister said Assad had no intention of stepping down. He delivered a speech many called incendiary. He called the opposition terrorists and waved his finger at the U.S.
No one, Mr. Kerry, in the world has the right to give legitimacy or to withdraw legitimacy from a president, a government, a constitution, or a law, or anything in Syria but Syrians.
The opposition says those Syrians are being brutalized. The government is accused of torturing protesters and indiscriminately targeting population centers. The opposition says it's the true representative of the Syrian people.
What Syrian people is talking about? Are they the 9.5 million displaced from their homes because of the bombing of his warplanes and his artillery and Scud missiles? Are they the 2.5 million that are already outside the border as a refugee? Because of that bombing? Are these the Syrian people he's talking about? I think he's talking about something else.
The opposition in the U.S. calls the Assad regime intransigent, and foreign minister overran his time.
I must finish my speech.
Then I will have to give
equal time
to Mr. opposition group. So
yourself, you live in New York, I live in Syria. I have the right to give the Syrian version here in this forum.
Yes, of course, you know, I
do not. After 3 years of suffering, this is my right.
The Syrian people are the ones who are suffering. Outside the conference, the opposition held a demonstration with a mock funeral, victims of what it calls Assad's war crimes. Just a few blocks away, pro-government protesters chanted mantras for the two sides to come closer together. But so far, they're as far apart as ever.
The newly revised Egyptian constitution passed in a referendum earlier this month, but it raised international concerns about fairness, the absence of public debate, and procedural violations. It passed with an extraordinary 98% of the vote, but the process was criticized for the arrests of those who campaigned against it. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry urged the military-led transitional authorities to fulfill their commitment to create an inclusive, democratic, and civilian-led government with free and fair elections. Over 38% of the electorate cast ballots in the two-day referendum last week, which is more than the previous constitution in December 2013 under President Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. The revised constitution was universally expected to pass, but the level of turnout was an open question due to the suppression of the opposition. The Muslim Brotherhood, which was formally outlawed 3 weeks ago, vehemently opposed the charter. No critics of the charter were allowed to speak to the media or express their views on the streets, and several activists were arrested for their views. The United States praised the Egyptian generals for, quote, restoring democracy after widespread protests of Morsi last year. Interim President Adli Mansour will call for a presidential election before parliamentary elections. This paves the way for General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, top general, to run for the presidency. Amid conspiracy theories that the United States might be secretly backing Morsi, Congress is paving the way for $1.3 billion in foreign aid to Cairo.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, gunmen have murdered five schoolboys who were playing volleyball in eastern Laghman province. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attack, which comes 5 days after a similar attack in Kandahar province, in which three boys playing soccer were killed by a rocket. Also, in the especially dangerous province of Balochistan, gunmen killed seven Pakistani police officers who were escorting two Spanish round-the-world cyclists as they entered the country from Iran. The group was ambushed in the town of Dalbandin, and the two cyclists were able to escape with only minor injuries. It is unclear who committed the attack, but Balochistan is full of potential suspects, including kidnappers, Taliban militants, separatist and sectarian insurgents, drug traffickers, and paramilitary death squads.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, January 23rd, 2014. Israeli tanks attack residents' homes in Gaza and settlers invade holy site in Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli tanks stationed at the southern Gaza borders opened fire at residents' homes and farmlands located in the town of Khan Yunis on Thursday evening. Witnesses told local media that a number of tanks invaded the border area and fired live ammunition at nearby homes and farmlands, causing damage but no injuries. In the meantime, Palestinian fighters said that they fired three homemade shells at nearby Israeli areas. No damage or injuries was reported by Israeli sources. In the West Bank, Israeli extreme right-wing group, under the protection of Israeli troops, invaded on Thursday Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Old City of Jerusalem. According to Palestinian groups, the settlers and troops toured the third holiest site for Muslims worldwide and then left. No clashes were reported. At the political level, Israeli Defense Minister approved plans to build 381 new homes in the Givat Ze'ev settlement, known as the third such announcement in this week. The Alternative Information Center, AIC, reports that on January 6, Israel approved plans for the construction of 272 housing units in various West Bank settlements, and that only 4 days later, it unveiled plans for the construction of 1,800 housing units in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Following the announcement of new constructions in Givat Ze'ev, Palestinian chief negotiator Saab Erekat told AFP that this decision confirms that Netanyahu's government only wants to continue settlement building, which will destroy any possible peace.
You You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Terry Eaton, Kristen Yount, Genevieve McDaniel, Robin Ryan, Rachel Bennett, Joe Meyer, Barbara. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or you can look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday, on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Positively Revolting looks at the state of women's reproductive rights in America and the world with the 41st anniversary of Roe versus Wade. How are we doing? Ani and Lynn will discuss these issues and take your calls. At 9, on One Land, Many Voices, co-hosts Ned Roche and Zaha Hassan interview Ziad Abbas from the Middle East Children Alliance and Mohammed Nabil, a Palestinian student from Gaza, about the crisis in Gaza as a result of the fuel shortage. Also, local activist Tom Bell talks with Zaha and Ned about the International Soda Stream and leafletting efforts at local Macy's and Target stores. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11:30, Don Merrill speaks with actor and comedian Wanda Sykes, who is also a spokesperson for GLAAD and PETA. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support for KBOO Community Radio. If you're not a member yet, become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned as KBOO's Joe Meyer interviews Lewis and Clark professor Tung Yin on the one-year anniversary of the Mohammed trial.
A year ago today, we were halfway through the Portland Christmas tree trial. Mohammed Mohammed was charged with using the U.S. mail system in conjunction with attempting to detonate a weapon of mass destruction. The defense, presented by public defenders Sadie, Hay, and Wax, was entrapment. What's the definition of entrapment in sentencing? What can we look for next? Lewis and Clark Law Professor Tung Yin has been following the case.
When we speak of attempt, usually what it means is you have to take some substantial step toward completion of the crime. But to back up your question about entrapment, could he be entrapped into that, if that's what I understand that you're asking, just about the mailing?
Right.
Entrapment, and this may be a problem with the way the doctrine is applied in these sorts of domestic terrorism cases, but entrapment really goes to the state of mind that the defendant had at the time when the government first got in touch with him. And everything after that doesn't really bear on the entrapment itself. It does bear on whether, in fact, there was, you know, an actual attempt at the commission of the crime. But since all of the mailings all post-date when the government first contacted him, the government had to persuade the jury that at the time they first contacted Mr. Mohammed, that he already was willing to engage in this kind of mass attack, and that they did not induce him by implanting the idea in his mind, which is why it was so important what happened in that first meeting, which ended up not being recorded because of the government's technical failures.
Right. So I think the government can argue that Mohammed, I guess they did argue that Mohammed had in mind this Pioneer Square thing. They made a big deal about that. But he certainly did not have in mind mailing a bunch of stuff to California.
Oh, I see what you mean. So the question is, if he did he have in mind the particular steps that it would take to accomplish the goal that he allegedly had in mind?
Well, a little bit more than that, because the mailing was part of the law that he broke. If he didn't mail, he would not have broken this specific law. You know, whether he found a storage shed or did a bunch of other chores is another matter. But I thought this was more relevant because it stated in statute that he, part of the crime that he committed is mailing across state lines.
Was that the prong that they proceeded under? Because
that's my understanding. And that's why they made a big deal about this mailing to California.
That's very interesting because that, which is the offense, affects interstate or foreign commerce, given the mass, the location, you know, downtown in Portland and so on. And this commerce clause is so broad that it justifies most of what Congress does.
Mm-hmm, okay.
But in any event, question of whether he thought about having to, whether he had in mind to do this particular act of mailing, it's what we call a jurisdictional element. It's one of the things that makes a crime a federal crime is to have some sort of hook that makes it a federal matter as opposed to a state matter. The idea being that the federal government is a government of limited powers, limited and enumerated powers. So there are certain things listed in Article 1 of the Constitution that say this is what Congress can do. It can legislate in these particular areas. And the government is supposed to be able to point to one of those to justify its assertion of authority. So you see, that's why the mails can be used, because the Constitution gives Congress the power to, the postal power, as we call it, the power to establish mails, mail routes, and so on. Commerce Clause is another power, the power to regulate interstate commerce. So that's why it's in the disjunctive in terms of what the hook is. But typically for federal criminal statutes, that kind of jurisdictional element is not something that you have to prove that the defendant had the mental state to violate. It just simply has to be proven that it was, in fact, done or attempted to be done.
Since the trial, there's been a series of postponements. What can we know about that?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Typically, after conviction, sentencing would take place 2 or 3 months later, and that's to give the probation officer time to write up the probation report or the pre-sentence report, give that to the parties, the government and the defendant. They can make their objections, and then the judge would read the papers and then sentence. And so this sentencing has been postponed for a long time now, since he was convicted at the end of January. So I was wondering at first if trying to work out, which is not very common. Usually you'd see the cooperation agreements occur before trial and typically resulting in a plea deal, a plea bargain of some sort. But now with the latest revelation that, the government has indicated that there was a lot of FISA-related material, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act material that it used, and now the defense is... it seems like mounting some kind of challenge, which I understand is under seal with the court, but they're trying to get more discovery. It may be that that the government simply used what it thought was inculpatory, that is the evidence from FISA that made Mohammed look guilty is what they introduced, and the defense has been fighting a lot about getting exculpatory material from the government. So that is part of the discovery motions, I think, but... you also have to wonder if they're making a full-scale challenge to the constitutionality of FISA itself. That is to say, it's not just that you didn't give us evidence that you're supposed to give us, but in fact, you never should have been able to get this evidence into trial in the first place because FISA is, we think, is unconstitutional. Now, defendants have made that argument before, and they've lost, because FISA has been upheld in this context. But that was before the Edward Snowden disclosures, and so maybe the time is ripe now to revisit the issue.
These delays have been happening for some months now, and there's some new revelation.
Right. So, and that's, I think, what's playing into this order that the judge issued, where he postponed the sentencing, and there's that line that... I'll rule on this, and if sentencing is still warranted, then sentencing will take place.
In that Justice Department memo, they didn't say they broke any laws. They said the sticking point there.
Well, so the issue is the Fourth Amendment says in very general terms that no unreasonable searches or seizures shall take place except upon issuance of a warrant, blah, 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 blah. So the idea is that, in general, before you or I or any person in the country is searched by the government needs to have a warrant backed up by probable cause. So that's the general default. Now, it turns out there are a lot of exceptions to the warrant requirement that have developed, and it basically takes an entire semester of criminal procedure to go through it here at the law school. FISA is a little bit different. For the FISA warrant, it's not probable cause that the person has committed a crime, which is your normal sort of law enforcement search warrant. FISA is about gathering foreign intelligence information. So the standard is probable cause to believe that the target is an agent of a foreign power. And so the tricky thing that comes up is, if what we're doing is we're spying on foreign governments and their agents so that our government can be more effective in foreign policy, there's no criminal implications. That's what FISA is most clearly about. What becomes tricky is, what happens if, while we're spying in this way, that we find out that somebody's committing a crime? Can the intelligence people who got the FISA warrant for spying purposes turn over evidence of criminal activity to law enforcement officials for prosecution purposes? That's what FISA is about. And pre-9/11, the Justice Department had interpreted FISA to make it very difficult to do this kind of information sharing. And then after 9/11 happened, and after the 9/11 Commission determined that one of the reasons that we didn't stop the plot was intelligence sharing failures, that is, the CIA knew about some of the 9/11 hijackers, and so did FBI intelligence analysts, but they didn't tell FBI law enforcement side people because of the wall. There was a lot of impetus to lower the wall, so to speak, to make it easier to share information. So in that sense, the government is right in saying that what they've done is comply with FISA as it's been interpreted. But what I gather the defense may be arguing in this case is to say that's not good enough, that interpretation of FISA to allow information sharing violates the Fourth Amendment. I think that's what their argument.
You mentioned prior to this latest Justice Department memo, they might have been negotiating. What's Mohammed have to negotiate with? He already lost.
I don't know, because I have never spoken to him, and I haven't talked to any of the lawyers in this case about this particular issue. But, you know, there are what he might be able to offer, let's say, would be if he's sincere about renouncing terrorism, is, you know, the kind of old scared straight model. You go and you speak to other people who might be in similar situations of potential radicalization and tell your story and the ending of it and what it is that you've concluded you were wrong about, and maybe try to keep other people from making the same mistake.
Any parallels to Boston?
The big question here is, when his dad had some concerns about his potential radicalization and he called the FBI, I mean, at one level, expecting the FBI would do, they're a law enforcement agency. But I think maybe we might say the tragedy is that they're really wanting to try to help him de-radicalize, if that makes sense. Or that is, we don't really know what he would have done. We think it looks like maybe he would have done some bad things given the way the case played out. But of course, you don't get to replay this. So we don't really know how dangerous he may have been. Whereas the Boston bombers, there was no government interaction at all there. I mean, those guys carried out their plot. So, or at least I guess we should say allegedly carried out the plot. So I think it's hard to see the parallels in terms of what might have been.
Right, exactly. Where does this Justice Department meld us? What's likely, a retrial or throw it out or?
Your seal, it's hard to know how serious of an issue this is for the defense. My guess is that it probably won't lead to a new trial in the Ninth Circuit on appeal, along with whether the defense should have gotten to question the undercover informants or agents much more about their background and identities, which they were not allowed to do. I think that would be another of the key issues on appeal. And then the last one, I think, is whether the government needed to show that Mr. Mohammed was predisposed to commit the exact kind of crime that is not just to kill a lot of people, but to do it with a bomb, a car bomb, at Pioneer Square.
And does that appeal typically happen after sentencing?
Yes. So after sentencing, the defendant would have 10 days to file a notice of appeal. And that's not the briefing itself. It's just simply that you intend to appeal. And then the Ninth Circuit would set a briefing schedule for when the briefs are due. So really, we're talking about several months after sentencing, several months to, you know, possibly a year after sentencing before it would go up before the Ninth Circuit.
Well, what could the judge have meant then by if sentencing is still appropriate?
Well, I think what that means is that if, based on the rule, the motions that the defense is filing now, the trial judge decides that, in fact, he is going to grant a new trial, then sentencing would not be appropriate. Then he would have a new trial.
Anything else for our listeners, Professor?
No, I mean, I think this case, you know, it continues to go on and on because of the defense is really putting in a lot of time. And, you know, it's obviously, I think, in some ways a bellwether case for much of the country because most of these cases plead out. And, you know, this is one that actually went to trial and went to trial with a very vigorous defense on the entrapment issue.
It was really interesting. Are we guaranteed that all the court documents will eventually be released?
I'm not sure because the government may be able to claim, I mean, you know, eventually if we mean by the end of time.
Within our lifetime, let's say.
you know, within our lifetime, possibly, depending on how healthy you are. But you know, there are obviously going to be a lot of investigations of this type, particularly if the government wins on appeal on the issue of keeping the identity of the informants secret, because, you know, obviously they're probably going to want to use these undercover agents again in future operations, since they seem to have particular skill sets relevant to this kind of work.
They sure do. We have to leave it there. Thanks for talking to me, Professor.
No problem.
Bye.
Bye.
That was Lewis and Clark Professor Tung Yin. He sees the Mohammed case as a bellwether for the entrapment defense. He sees next steps as either an appeal to the Ninth Circuit or a retrial. For more on the Mohammed trial, tune in next Wednesday evening, January 29th, 6 to 8 p.m. for the KABU docudrama Mo is Shy. This has been Joe Meyer for KABU News In Depth.
And this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Radio are proud to present a very special evening this Sunday at 7 p.m. at the Holy Redeemer Church. Han Bennick and Mary Oliver return to Portland in a special concert featuring quartets and quintets with many gifted local musicians. Han Bennick, co-founder of Europe's premier creative music collective, the Instant Composers Pool, since 1967 and still going today, has recorded with everyone from jazz legends Eric Dolphy, Sonny Rollins, Wes Montgomery, and Dexter Gordon, to experimentalists of today, such as Eugene Chadbourne, Steve Lacy, Peter Brotzman, and Dave Douglas. One never knows what to expect on an evening with Han Bennick, so be sure to join us this Sunday night at 7 p.m. at the Holy Redeemer Church, corner of Northeast 20th and Killingsworth, for a Creative Music Guild special concert, Han Bennick and Mary Oliver. This is a presentation of the Creative Music Guild. For more information, go to creativemusicguild.org.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor the 24th annual Cascades Festival of African Films, which will be held from January 31st through March 1st at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus and the Hollywood Theater. The 24th season will open with Gree Gree, a drama set in Chad, following a young man who, despite suffering from partial paralysis, becomes a renowned dancer at the local nightclub. The film will show on January 31st at 6:30 and 9 at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard, Portland, Oregon. Over 20 films will be screened in this year's 24th annual Cascade African Film Festival, beginning on January 31st, running through March 1st. For more information, please go to our website at kboo.fm and click on the right to event.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by the KBOO Foundation, members, and a grant from the Museum of the Oregon Territory, presenting Willamette Falls, Where the Future Began, a day of exhibits, papermaking, workshops, film, and tribal art, Saturday, February 1st in Oregon City. Willamette Falls will include a blessing song by the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Road, the Once Lost Fish Mural by Alex Schomburg, a kids concert by Spider Moccasin, and more. Details at clackamashistory.org.
What makes you such a threat?
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Takos kaskan on pikele na yuha. Makakele. Hakan haka takum echaki ake heon. On a hoki chila money picked. Makakele o hoki la moshi. Heon heche. Leon yu tan.
Tatani ma.